Welcome to VMN Volume 3, Episode 18. The date is August 16th, 2023. VMN is produced and transmitted from unceded Abenaki territory of so-called Vermont. Today we will be talking with Lauren Regan from the CLDC, Civil Liberties Defense Center, about the recent Andy Ngo trial and the implications for leftists and people who fight against the far right and fascism. Andy Ngo has positioned himself both as an expert on the left and Antifa and an implacable opponent of both. His reporting is well known to be manipulated to support his ideological positions. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the CLDC does? I mean, I've known you all for years and I know your name and I'm delighted to see you. But maybe our listeners don't know about the CLDC. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. For the last 20 years, we have defended environmental and social justice activists around the country. We defend them in state and federal criminal courts when they are charged with crimes. We also represent them in suing police and government agencies when their civil and constitutional rights are violated. We also do a lot of Know Your Rights trainings around issues like how to interact with cops and security culture, digital security, state repression, grand juries. We've got a bunch of free webinars that we've done over the last couple of years that are available on a whole host of topics on our website.
Excellent, excellent. For those few listeners not familiar with Andy Ngo, who is he and what does he do?
Andy Ngo is a far-right provocateur. He calls himself a journalist and does appear that when he was in college, he started working for a campus newspaper until he was terminated. He wrote a book. He attempts to portray himself, you know, as you mentioned, as someone who has infiltrated and studied far left political movements, which is really not at all true. But primarily, he is someone that has abhorrent beliefs and has managed to profit incredibly handsomely off of manipulating and playing upon others who he riles up to engage in acts of violence, doxing, harassment, et cetera, et cetera. So he kind of winds people up and then shoots them off toward others and pretends to have clean hands, you know, once people are injured or doxed or other things like that.
Yeah, I've known quite a few people who've ended up on his Antifa Watch website. That's sort of become a badge of honor for some of my friends. Can you give us some background on the trial that he just lost?
Sure. In his book, he basically admitted that he wanted to utilize what the far right calls lawfare, which is basically using the legal system as warfare, meaning that they are attempting to abuse the legal system and the legal process to expose anti-fascist organizers and activists, to harass, intimidate, and chill people from exercising their rights to speak out against racists and anti-Semites. And so a couple of years ago, in 2020, he filed this lawsuit alleging several different acts, torts, which are basically things like assault, battery, emotional distress, against several individuals and a Portland entity called Rose City Antifa. And let's see how. So the lawsuit basically attempted to say that certain individuals, you know, threw a milkshake at him while he was trolling people at far right protests. There was an incident that was alleged by one of the folks at trial, John Hacker. He accused John of dripping a little bit of water on his head as he walked down the stairs of the 24-hour fitness gym that both of them went to. And then he accused both Elizabeth Richter and John Hacker of identifying him while he was undercover at a Black Lives Matter protest, where he was basically spying on anti-racist activists. They identified him primarily because he stood out by wearing a Black Lives Matter flag draped around his shoulders like a shawl, as only the far right generally does. So he was pretty obvious. These two individuals kind of, you know, said, "That's Andy No." And then an unknown group of people chased him down in the streets of Portland, Oregon, beat him up. He ran into a hotel where he cowered on his hands and knees behind a desk, and then sued Elizabeth and John as if they were the ones that had assaulted him. And so prior to the trial that just happened, Rose City Antifa was dismissed from the case. The court ruled that it wasn't an entity that could be sued. You know, in essence, it's a campaign. It's not an organization. It doesn't have a board or bank accounts or like any of the normal things that Oregon courts require in order to actually sue an organization or a business or, you know, something of that kind. So Rose City got tossed early on. There were a couple of people who got default judgments against them. And basically what that means is they either never knew about the lawsuit, you know, didn't know that they were named in the lawsuit, or they chose not to engage with Andy's abuse of the legal system. In at least one of the cases, we know that the person just simply had no clue that they had been named in the lawsuit. And part of the reason was Andy and his lawyers attempted to serve different people. But, you know, as you and your listeners may know, anti-fascist organizers often try to keep their private homes private for security issues, you know, because they are so targeted and doxxed by violent far-right extremists. So they couldn't be properly served according to like the court rules. And so the lawyers did what's called service by publication, which means they just put it in the newspaper and said, "You've been served." And, you know, I think it's probably fair to surmise that a lot of anti-fascist activists and organizers are not reading the legal notices in the Oregonian newspaper. And so it's certainly likely that a number of people didn't know that they had been named in this lawsuit. And so then that's why only John and Elizabeth were the two defendants that went to trial. That's the background.
What can the people who got defaults against, can they do anything about it? Or are they basically screwed at this point?
That is a matter that is currently being researched for folks. I really don't have an answer for you right now. Normally, if a default judgment is entered, there are some narrow ways that you can cry foul, you know, and try to get it opened up again. But if that can't happen, you know, right now, you know, to kind of cut to the chase, like, the jury came back and found no liability for anybody in the case. And the jury never made any rulings or findings that Andy gets a dime, you know? So right now, even though there is a default judgment, there's no dollar amount attached to the judgment. So it's kind of an open, weird legal question that we're going to kind of have to wait and see. The other thing I'll just say is sometimes activists will end up with default judgments, but because they don't have assets, you know, they don't own a house, they don't have a trust fund, you know, they don't have big bank accounts, there, you know, there's a saying, you can't get blood out of a turnip. And so, you know, often these types of judgments are really hard to collect upon.
So it's basically symbolic. What are the implications of this case? Does this make things better for the left, for those fighting the right? What does this mean? Does it hurt Andy in any way?
Well, so I think first of all, I would say that in the last 3 to 5 years here at the CLDC, we have seen a pretty significant uptick in the number of lawsuits being filed against anti-fascists and anti-fascist organizations around the country. So this is one of several cases that are currently ongoing around the country. And so I think the significant parts are, you know, number one, the court ruling that said Rose City Antifa is not an organization that can be sued, period. That means community anti-fascist collectives and organizations around the country that also operate in a similar way will have a court ruling that they can attempt to use, depending on their state law, to basically say that, like, our campaign, you know, our little group is not an entity that can be sued. And the significance of that is, you know, one of the things that Andy was really wanting was what's called discovery, which is where they can take depositions of people, they can ask for records. And, you know, that was really sort of the dream for Andy, was to crawl up the nose of anti-fascists and their organizations, force them to give up private information, mental health info, health, you know, all sorts of things in order to humiliate, intimidate, expose how groups pick targets, who their friends are, where they get their money, you know, all sorts of private things. And in this lawsuit, Andy got none of that from Rose City, which also is significant. And even with regard to Elizabeth and John, the discovery was very, very narrow. And he never really got what he wanted, you know, from that process. So that aspect is good. I think the other significant aspect of this case is at trial, John Hacker took the stand and said, yeah, I was at the 24-hour fitness gym. I saw Andy Ngo there. I hate Andy Ngo. He has caused incredible harm to many of my good friends, and I was really pissed. And so when I saw him going down the stairs, I took my water bottle and I poured some water and it landed on his head. And then when he came running up the stairs at me and started trying to film me so that he could dox me, I hit his phone out of his hand and his phone hit the rubber, you know, floor at the gym. Under Oregon civil law, that could technically, you know, be something akin to a tort. But the jury, you know, after being told what the law is in Oregon and having those facts, 100% acquitted John and Elizabeth of everything. And to me, I think in part that was because Andy came off like an ass clown. You know, I think Andy did not garner sympathy from this Multnomah County jury. I think that a lot of the jurors knew what Andy knows politics are, you know, was and are. And I think in many ways, they believed that he, you know, had engaged in conduct and that was, you know, what you get type of thing, which I think, you know, hard to know whether, you know, obviously Portland is a pretty progressive city, you know, Multnomah County is not, entirely progressive, but certainly, probably not as conservative or far right as many other parts of the country. Also, Portland and Multnomah County have had a lot of really horrible Patriot Front, Proud Boy, far right, ugly, ugly actions, marches, protests that the citizenry just kind of looks at and is repulsed. So I think the way that the jury took in this case and responded to this case is significant as well.
Can you talk about the representation that Andy had? Who is, did he have some right-wing organization bankrolling his lawsuit, or is this just something he paid for? Do you know this?
So originally he had a lawyer in Portland that certainly does have some ties to far right politics and ideologies. The lawyers that represented him at trial were these two lawyers, Dorothy Yamamoto and Michael Gregory from the same firm. They are based in the Bay Area. Strangely, according to the website, Dorothy Yamamoto teaches a basic legal writing class at UC Hastings Law School, which is actually a really generally progressive law school. I kind of wonder what a lot of her students would think if they knew that she defended Andy Ngo. She tried to make him a sympathetic character, I think. There was a strange situation where, like, right before the trial, at the trial ready call, we were told that the Oregon lawyer, who was serving as their local counsel because they're out of state and not licensed in Oregon, we were told that he had COVID and couldn't appear. And so, that was kind of curious. And so it was just the two of them at the counsel table. And on the defense side, it was Michelle Burrows, Cooper Brinson, who is a former CLDC staff attorney, Marianne Dugan, who is one of our current CLDC attorneys, myself, several law clerks and legal workers that were all, working pretty tirelessly to defend Elizabeth and John.
What other cases are ongoing of this sort that you can talk about at all?
Well, I think the other weird one is actually in a federal court in New Jersey on your side of the country, where the Torch Network, along with several anti-fascist individuals, are being sued, is tied to the anti-fasc Gordon matter. And that case is ongoing, so I don't want to comment too much on it. But I will say that the plaintiffs, not only did they sue anti-fascist activists and the Torch Network, but they also sued a couple of universities, some major media outlets, Twitter, and so some of these big corporate entities and big universities had big giant law firms that just hammered on this kind of wingnut of a plaintiff's lawyer that filed this case. So the case is still slightly limping along, but I really hope that would-be far-right plaintiff's lawyers are looking at some of these cases and realizing that this is not going to be a moneymaker for them, that it's going to be a lot of hard work, and that anti-fascist activists and organizers are going to be well represented by movement lawyers and legal clinics and, all sorts of good lawyer representation.
I can't imagine that the plaintiff in the torch case has a lot of financial backing for this. I wouldn't want to be representing Mr. D'Amblay because I would be concerned about if I could recover my fees.
Yeah, normally in federal civil actions like this, there's something called an attorney fee provision, which basically says like whatever side wins can attempt to collect attorney fees and costs from the other side under certain circumstances. So a lot of lawyers, plaintiffs' lawyers, you know, like when we sue cops, we have that same provision. If we win a lawsuit against the cops have to pay our full attorney fee bill that we submit to them. And so that can be, you know, years worth of hourly wages. And so often plaintiffs' lawyers are looking at these types of cases as, you know, income producing after a few years. And it's important for, you know, these far right plaintiffs and their would-be lawyers to know that there is not going to be money at the end of the you know, end of the line. Not only because they're more likely than not going to lose the lawsuits, but also the people that they are going after are judgment proof, meaning they don't, there's not going to be money that you're going to be able to collect from them. You know, when I sue cops, the cops' insurance pays me. You know, I know I'm getting paid because I'm suing a city. You know, I'm suing a police department. But when you are suing Anti-Fash Gordon, yeah, there's not the same kind of deep pockets that are going to pay that bill at the end of the day.
There was another case where the I think four members of the of Patriot Front are suing some anti-fascists who infiltrated them, and they're suing for exposing their identities. Can you discuss the what this means?
Yeah, so that case was filed in the federal court in Western Washington. And it is my understanding that none of the named defendants have actually been served yet. So that is not an active case yet. But yeah, Patriot Front is the plaintiff. And they are basically accusing individuals of infiltrating the organization and then, you know, whistleblowing and exposing their communications and other things publicly. It's brand new. You know, that's a new case, but certainly an interesting one and an important one. You know, the strange thing is that similar shit has happened where far right jerks have infiltrated far left organizations and basically did the same thing. And of course, the far left never sued over it. But you know, again, I think that this is part of a larger legal strategy by the far right. You know, I think obviously we all know that the far right has been greatly emboldened since Trump, basically. And, you know, I think right now, the far right, you know, especially Proud Boys, Patriot Front, anything left of center, they are claiming is Antifa. You know, like reproductive justice activists in Florida are currently being labeled as Antifa. You know, any, you know, GLBT, like, you know, you name it, if it's a social justice issue in the US that is not racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, you know, anti-Islamic, then the far right is going to label it as Antifa and anti-fascist. Which, you know, on the one hand, under the definition of anti-fascism is probably true. And on the other hand, you know, is part of that culture war that they are really trying to stir up and really accelerate as we head toward the next election with like Trump and DeSantis, you know, picking their noses in Florida. Probably some of the most problematic social politics, in the country right now. I think that this is part of a trend. I think that the far right has dug deep into the pockets of a lot of their wealthy conservative funders in order to kind of bring some of this litigation. I do think that we do need to be looking seriously at the lawyers and law firms that are taking on these cases, because, not only are they profiting at some point from this, but, lawyers also have a lot of sway with regard to political movements, historically and currently. And so if there weren't lawyers willing to take on representation of the Patriot Front, then the Patriot Front would be unable to abuse the legal system in this way. I think all of that, is certainly on the table for discussion right now.
With regards to anti-trans and anti-gay stuff, a pattern has emerged. It's the Alliance Defending Freedom. It's that fake pediatrics group, ACPED. They're basically calling the shots. Has a pattern emerged with these anti-Antifa lawsuits that we can actually determine where it's coming from?
Not that I know of now. There are some incredible researchers in this anti-fascist movement that probably should look at that, more seriously. For us as lawyers, we're, just really trying to defend as many people as we can in court. And, we've got a lot of cases and a lot of work going on. And I honestly haven't done a deep dive into, what may be the themes that can be uncovered, but I'm sure the movement itself can figure that out and report back to us.
This is a hint to any good researchers listening to dig into these lawyers and find out who they are. Like a lot of the right-wing speaking points come from a person named Chris Rufo. And similarly, it may be true with law stuff. Are there any cases in the past that are long settled that you can talk about that would illuminate what this pattern is happening?
I think one of the patterns is trying to name known anti-fascists, whether, media or like community exposures. Maybe they were doxxed, maybe they got arrested, at a protest or an action, and their names became known. That becomes the low-hanging fruit for the far right to name those individuals or organizations as defendants. So that's, that's one thing that is happening. And especially during and after the George Floyd Black Lives Matter uprisings, there were kind of a slew of arrests and prosecutions of anti-racist, anti-fascist activists that were arrested and prosecuted. And so there was sort of an opportunistic feeding frenzy around that time period with regard to the names of people. Let's see, I think that I am not aware of any far-right lawsuits. Maybe somebody's going to correct me on this, but I'm not aware of any far-right lawsuits along this line that have actually been successful and that have actually won. We had a case where this woman who was called the Weed Nazi, because she like owned a cannabis store or something like that, she was outed as the Weed Nazi and then sued John Jane Doe's and the Eugene anti-fascist group for defamation and whatnot. We represented the John Jane Doe's and got that case quickly thrown out. And really all she did was nationalize her moniker as the weed Nazi, and then had to close down her business and move out of town. Small tear down your cheek there. You know, the funny thing about some of these knee-jerk defamation lawsuits, just for your listeners, defamation is the lawyer word for libel and slander, which basically means you knowingly tell a lie about someone that causes economic harm. So truth is a defense to either of those things. And you know, it's not just that I call you a naughty name, it's that by calling you that name, you lose money, you know, that you have to be able to show that you've lost money, that you've been economically harmed, and you have to prove that I knew it was false and that it was actually false. So when these Nazis are suing people for calling them Nazis, it just gives people a stage to put on all the evidence that exists that in fact they really are a Nazi. So like with the weed Nazi case, you know, basically we were able to give the court all of these tweets and social media and photos of them being Nazis. And there just was absolutely no dispute that they were Nazis. And so the case got thrown out because truth is a defense. So, you know, I think it kind of becomes almost fun to be able to show the world that, in fact, you know, these people really do have incredibly ignorant and abhorrent beliefs. You know, I remember when Trump first came into office and far right, you know, and Nazis started showing up on the streets, you know, giving the Sieg Heil salute and wearing, you know, Nazi propaganda. I remember thinking to myself, like, I really want to remember these faces because at some point they will crawl back under that rock. You know, once again, it will become societally abhorrent to openly display these beliefs, and they will hide them again, you know, and I wanted to be able to remember who it was in my community that came out and showed us all who they really were. And I think these types of lawsuits are really a way to create historic record around people who really doubled down on, you know, these far right extremist beliefs, were willing to engage in violence, were, you know, really doing harm to democracy, to society, and certainly to individuals and their communities, you know, through their words and actions.
So if an anti-fascist group, say, infiltrates some far-right group, what kind of liability do they have for just, say, you find a Proud Boy group on Facebook and you infiltrate that, then you expose all that? What kind of legal liability could you actually have for that?
Well, I think we might see, you know, in this lawsuit, so I don't necessarily want to comment on that, but generally speaking, historically, you know, we know that political opponents have often infiltrated each other's political work and exposed it. You know, that is a real common way to undermine your adversary. You know, there have been a couple of cases in the past. Like, for instance, I remember PETA, the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, had done a lot of campaigning around trying to stop the abuse of circus animals. And they were infiltrated by someone who worked for Ringling Brothers or, you know, worked for the circus industry. That person applied for a job and lied on their job application and then got a job, you know, with the organization and then, you know, stole data and information as an employee. That is a different situation, you know, because you've got an employment contract. There's like employment law in place. You sign a confidentiality agreement. So that type of scenario is a little bit different than, you know, what we're seeing with regard to this Patriot Front, you know, and what has happened, you know, in the past with regard to some anti-fascist groups as well. In those situations, you know, there's usually not contracts that are being signed. And if a group doesn't do their due diligence in vetting a new member and they put them in a vulnerable situation where they have access to private information, et cetera, historically, that's on you. You know, whether it happens to us or it happens to them, you know, that has normally not been a crime and has not been something that has been, you know, that has resulted in legal action. So in this case, the lawsuit, you know, is sort of like alleging things that are akin to fraud. You lied to us. You said us you were one of us and you weren't, you know, type of thing. And then you took our secure text messages and posted them, you know, and we didn't like that. And that caused us to get, you know, fired from our jobs, or, you know, our children hate us now, or, you know, whatever the harm alleged may be. But I think we'll see what the courts are going to do with that. I don't think it looks good for the Patriot Front. But I also, you know, have not done any deep diving, legally speaking, into that case yet.
So what are we going to see going forward? What do you foresee? If you had a, what's your crystal ball saying?
Well, my crystal ball has two different halves to it. You know, like the optimistic half is that far right and their lawyers are going to look at what has happened over the last few years of their legal forays, and they're going to think, that wasn't so fun. Maybe we'll try something else, and you know, and maybe we'll see a decrease in the number of these types of cases being brought. That's my optimistic side. I think maybe the more realistic view, though, is the far right is going to double down as we head into the elections, you know, and beyond. I mean, the rhetoric around Trump and those far right anti-democratic beliefs is really just becoming more and more virulent. It seems like there are even mainstream political entities trying to push minions into acts of violence, or, you know, like I think the January 6th, you know, situation was an example of a big mouth being able to churn people into doing acts that they probably would never have otherwise done. And so I think we've got a lot of sheep at the wheel, you know, in terms of the far right that are pretty easily manipulated and are being amplified or accelerated into more extremist acts. You know, I think that using the legal system as one of those toys will maybe even seem milquetoast compared to some of the things we're probably going to see over the next few years, unfortunately.
Speaking of stochastic terrorism, when some big mouth gets fools to do violence for them, what in the American legal system, is there any real remedy for that?
I mean, normally the most common remedy would be that the state would prosecute those people, that the state would arrest them and prosecute them. You know, I think, unfortunately, when it comes to law enforcement, who does that on the ground investigative work, we've seen a number of instances where the bias of law enforcement is not in our favor. And so if you've got cops on the ground who aren't doing investigations, who aren't arresting people, who aren't charging them with serious crimes, then that process is not going to result in people being arrested and prosecuted and jailed. And, you know, as an abolitionist organization, you know, that's not exactly something that we're super, you know, thrilled about. I think that, you know, if someone is injured, you know, by a far right attack, they also can use the civil court system to seek money and other damages, you know, injunctions and restraining orders and things like that. You know, but again, the legal system is certainly perceived by many to be racist and inadequate, especially at engaging in this kind of political, you know, turmoil. So I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, certainly important for mutual aid, you know, community groups to be trying to take care of their own communities first and foremost. I think that, you know, education, especially of young people who are being exposed heavily in social media platforms and being, you know, indoctrinated or militarized to far-right ideologies through social media. Like, I think we really do need to understand and figure out a plan to address and try to de-escalate those scenarios. Because obviously I think some of those old racist dogs may be too far gone to see the light, but there are generations coming up that, due to the psychological manipulations of social media, are holding hopefully transient and temporary views as a result of that, that we really do need to address and fix and, you know, nurture people to be better humans.
Definitely, definitely. I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball. One of my favorite, I'm an abolitionist as well, but one of the cases I talk with about a lot about is regarding hate speech. It's the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda, where the ICTR actually discussed the Ohio versus Blackburn, I think it was, and said that that decision is moot. It talks about you can talk, you can speech can go up to where it provokes imminent violence, but the ICTR, International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda, said that it's moot on what imminent means. If I'm talking on social media about how I should kill group X or Y, and it's clear that it's going to happen if I keep doing it, and it may be a year, the ICTR said that's imminent, and it said it was moot. What do you, can you talk a little bit about this line of thinking?
Well, I think first, you know, generally international law is not binding in US courts. So we can talk about it to judges, but they're often not very persuaded by it, you know, just as a practical matter. You know, I think the indictment of Trump right now, with regard to January 6th, maybe, you know, somewhat of an interesting test of that, because, you know, in that situation, they're basically saying, like, a speech he made and, you know, the ongoing communications that he made running up to that point resulted in, you know, these acts of violence. So yeah, we'll see. You know, that line of constitutional law regarding calls to action and where the line is drawn between free speech and criminal speech, you know, is changing. Just like all constitutional laws and principles can change over time. It's a little frightening given the current makeup of the Supreme Court, that is happening. But It certainly wouldn't surprise me if, as time passes, especially when people wrote the original Constitution, they certainly were not thinking about Twitter, and the speed with which communications can be shared so vastly, but also that remain, and exist for so much longer other than just the moment that we spit out the words. I think when a lot of those cases were in front of the Supreme Court, it was a speech on a soapbox, and the test was, did you have pitchforks right nearby that people could grab and go get the person or not? And the framework has completely changed. So, I do think that that the question is up for debate. And I kind of hope it doesn't get to the Supreme Court until a few people, maybe fall off the court.
Yeah, the United States is so out of line with the rest of the world with regards to speech that can incite violence. It's sort of an outlier in that.
Yeah, and then when you also compare the US to many other countries in the world that don't even have anything that resembles a First Amendment, they have no speech rights. So, I think the reason that I have been able to do this kind of work for 25 years is, I can see both the glass half full, and I, can definitely honestly view it as half empty as well.
Well, this has been an interesting conversation. Is there anything you want to close on before I read us out?
Well, I think that, when it comes to anti-fascist political work, which is such important work both historically and in our current moment, it's important for people of all stripes to show up and stand in solidarity. It can't just be a small group of 20-year-old black-clad individuals. It needs to be teachers and people of faith and it needs to be a very wide spectrum of our communities standing in solidarity against fascism and against this, type of hate. And I think when we have maybe more normal community members coming into spaces, showing up at a Proud Boy rally to make sure that they know they're not welcome. It's important for folks to know what they're getting into before they get into it, both in terms of personal security, digital security, what their rights are, et cetera, et cetera. And so maybe I'll sing us out by just saying, cldc.org is our website, and we've got a bunch of resources for folks that are free, easily accessible. And before you jump into it, just make sure that you have your feet underneath you. We really want people to have knowledge and consent before they engage in political activity, out on the streets right now.
And I cannot recommend CLDC more because when I've done security trainings, I always review the CLDC recommendations. I look at EFF and some of the people I talk to, the security needs are much higher. I actually use things like Ricochet and Quutch or Briar to speak to some people that whose location should not be known. As somebody who teaches security, I am always frustrated when people bring their cell phones to demonstrations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, the courts have ruled that your cell phone is the equivalent of like 100 filing cabinets full of your most confidential information. And so it is a treasure trove if it ends up in the hands of either cops or your adversaries. So, I think a best practice, especially if you are, bringing your phone for camera purposes or other things, you might need a throwaway phone, you know, a burner phone to be used for those purposes, one that has no information, you know, or photos or contacts or anything like that in it. You know, nowadays, if your phone gets taken from you by the cops, one of the first things they're going to do is plug it into a digital forensic device. And even if you have a password protected phone, there is certain information like your contacts, your photos, you and other info that they are absolutely going to be able to extract and look at, even though your phone is password protected. So our bottom line rule is think before you type. You know, people have gotten overly confident in using encrypted apps like Signal. You still need to think, should I ever type this and send it to someone? Because we've had lots of circumstances where cops have grabbed somebody's phone and they stand there and they watch the phone and the person has Signal notifications popping up on their home screen, and the cops are just watching every Signal message pop up on the screen and leave. So then a whole Signal group chat and all of its contents are exposed and are being used as evidence to prosecute others. So just because there is this thing called encrypted apps doesn't mean that you should be typing naughty things in it, things that could expose you or others to criminal consequences. You know, still the old school, like meeting and having conversations face to face without a phone being present, you know, is still, you know, the most secure way to communicate with each other. Because if you're creating any form of paper trail, and when I say paper trail, I mean digital paper trail, you know, that's a problem. And all phones have GPS tracking capabilities. You know, particularly your phone itself has a tracker on it that was actually developed to market advertisements to you. But now law enforcement is using it in order to prove that you and your phone were at a particular location where a crime was committed. And so just physically having your phone on you gives the state evidence against you potentially, just merely by possessing the phone. You know, you can use things like a Faraday bag, you know, for a little better protection, but I'm sure as you are aware, there is no such thing as 100% security. No one should ever have the false illusion that taking steps to make yourself safer is foolproof. You know, the only way to be foolproof is to not engage with the device and create the record to begin with.
Thank you. And I was just advising a group that had messages from Facebook used against them in a far right newspaper about this, and they typed on what they thought was a private Facebook group, and it was used against them. So Lauren, thank you very much. It's really an honor to talk to you, and
thanks,
I will read us out. And so if you like this podcast, please consider sharing and liking it on your social media. Reviews help drive the algorithms that basically run the internet world. So please, if you have the time to leave a review on your podcast aggregator, do it. Reviews on Apple and Google help a lot if you are willing to deal with those companies. And I leave that up to you whether you want to do that. This was VMN Volume 3, Episode 18. VMN was formerly known as Vermont Movement News and can be found on podcast apps as Vermont Movement News. Thank you very much.